Thank you very much, and thank you for that kind introduction. And I'm just back from 3 weeks out of the country in England and Ireland, and I hope to be writing about Ireland pretty soon. It's the first colony, you know, for the Brits. And apparently it's going to be the last. They're hanging on. And it's evil. So I was very privileged to travel in Ireland and get up into Northern Ireland and Belfast in particular. And so I hope soon to be sharing with you my eyewitness account of the Northern Ireland struggle. And I'm going to be writing a series of poems called Irish Poems. And the last poem of which I've written and already, and I'll read that tonight. Apparently there was a mistake in the advertising for this event of some sort. People said this was going to be essays as well as poetry. So I will begin with an essay and then go on to the poetry so nobody will feel, I hope nobody will feel cheated. This is called Requiem for the Champ. Mike Tyson comes from Brooklyn, and so do I. Where he grew up was about a 20-minute bus ride from my house. I always thought his neighborhood looked like a war zone. It reminded me of Berlin immediately after World War II. I had never seen Berlin except for black and white photos in Life magazine, but that was bad enough. Rubble, barren, blasted. Everywhere you turned, your eyes recoiled from the jagged edges of an office building or a cathedral shattered or the tops of apartment houses torn off and nothing alive even intimated anywhere. I used to think, this is what it means to fight and really win or really lose. War means you hurt somebody or something until there's nothing soft or sensible left. For sure, I never had a boyfriend who came out of Mike Tyson's territory. Yes, I enjoyed my share of tough guys and or gang members who walked and talked and fought and loved in quintessential Brooklyn ways, cool, tough, and deadly serious. But there was a code as rigid and as romantic as anything that ever made the pages of traditional English literature. A guy would beat up another guy, or if appropriate, he'd kill him. But a guy talked different to a girl. A guy made other guys clean up their language around his girl. A guy brought ribbons and candies and earrings and tulips to a girl. He took care of her. He walked her home. And if he got serious about that girl, and even if she was only 12 years old, then she became his lady. And woe betide any other guy stupid enough to disrespect that particular young black female. But none of the boys, none of the young men, none of the young black male inhabitants of my universe and my heart ever came from Mike Tyson's streets or avenues. We didn't live someplace fancy or middle class, but at least there were 10-cent gardens front and back, and coin laundromats, and grocery stores, and soda parlors, and barbershops, and holy roller church fronts, and chicken shacks, and dry cleaners, and bars and grills, and a takeout Chinese restaurant, and all of that usable detail that does not survive a war. That kind of seasonal green turf and daily life-supporting pattern of establishments to meet your needs did not exist inside the gelid urban cemetery where Mike Tyson learned what he thought he needed to know. I remember when the city of New York decided to construct a senior housing project there in the childhood world of former heavyweight boxing champion Mike Tyson. I remember wondering, where in the hell will those old people have to go in order to find food, and how will they get there? I'm talking godforsaken, and much of living in Brooklyn was like that. But then it might rain or it might snow, and for example, I could look at the rain forcing forsythia into bloom or watch how snowflakes can tease bare tree limbs into temporary blossoms of snow dissolving into diadems of sunlight. And what did Mike Tyson ever see besides brick walls and garbage in the gutter and disintegrating concrete steps and boarded up windows and broken car parts blocking the sidewalk and men bitter with their hands in their pockets and women bitter with their heads down and their eyes almost closed? In his neighborhood, where could you buy ribbons for a girl or tulips? Mike Tyson comes from Brooklyn, and so do I. In the big picture of America, I never had much going for me, and he had less. I only learned last year that I can stop whatever violence starts with me. I only learned last year that love is infinitely more interesting and more exciting and more powerful than really winning or really losing a fight. I only learned last year that all war leads to death and that all love leads you away from death. I am more than twice Mike Tyson's age, and I'm not stupid or slow, but I'm black and I come from Brooklyn and I grew up fighting and I grew up and I got out of Brooklyn because I got pretty good at fighting and winning, or else intimidating my would-be adversaries with my fists, my feet, and my mouth. And I never wanted to fight. I never wanted anybody to hit me, and I never wanted to hit anybody. But the bell would ring at the end of another dumb day in school, and I'd head out with dread and a nervous sweat because I knew some jackass, more or less my age and more or less my height, would be waiting for me because she or he had nothing better to do than to wait for me and hope to kick my butt or tear up my books or break my pencils or pull hair out of my head. This is the meaning of poverty. When you have nothing better to do than to hate somebody who, just exactly like yourself, has nothing better to do than to pick on you instead of trying to figure out how come there's nothing better to do. How come there's no gym, no swimming pool, no dirt track, no soccer field, no ice skating rink, no bike path, no tennis courts, no language arts workshop, no computer science center, no band practice, no choir rehearsal, no music lessons, no basketball or baseball team? How come neither one of you has his or her own room in a house where you can hang out and dance and make out or get on the telephone or eat and drink up everything in the kitchen that can move? How come nobody on your block and nobody in your class has any of these things? I'm black. Mike Tyson is black. And neither one of us was ever supposed to win anything more than a fight between the two of us. And if you check out the mass media material on us, and if you check out the emergency room reports on us, you might well believe we're losing the fight to be more than our enemies have decreed. Our enemies would deprive us of everything except each other, hungry and furious and drug addicted and rejected and ever convinced we can never be beautiful or right or true or different from the beggarly monsters our enemies envision and insist upon. And how should we then stand, black man and black woman, face to face? Way back when I was born, Richard Wright had just published Native Son and thereby introduced white America to the monstrous product of its racist hatred. Poverty does not beautify. Poverty does not teach generosity or allow for sucker attributes of tenderness and restraint. In white America, hatred of black folks has imposed horrible poverty upon us. And so back in the 30s, Richard Wright's native son, Bigger Thomas, did what he thought he had to do. He hideously murdered a white woman, and he viciously murdered his black girlfriend in what he conceived as self-defense. He did not perceive any options to these psychopathic, horrifying deeds. I do not believe he, Bigger Thomas, had any other choices open to him. Not to him, he who was meant to die like the rat he, Bigger Thomas, cornered and smashed to death in his mother's beggarly clean space. I never thought Bigger Thomas was okay. I never thought he should skate back into my or anyone's community. But I did, and I do think he is my brother. The choices available to us dehumanize, and any single one of us, black in this white country, we may be defeated, we may become dehumanized by the monstrous hatred arrayed against us and our needy dreams. And so I write this requiem for Mike Tyson, international celebrity, millionaire, former heavyweight boxing champion of the world, a big-time winner, a big-time loser, an African-American male in his 20s, and now a convicted rapist. Do I believe he is guilty of rape? Yes, I do. And what would I propose as appropriate punishment? Whatever will force him to fear the justice of exact retribution, and whatever will force him for the rest of his damned life to regret and to detest the fact that he defiled, he subjugated, and he wounded somebody helpless to his power. And do I therefore rejoice in the jury's finding? I do not. Well, would I like to see Mike Tyson a free man again? He was never free. And I do not excuse or condone or forget or minimize or forgive the crime of his violation of the young black woman he raped. But did anybody ever tell Mike Tyson that you talk different to a girl? Where would he learn that? Would he learn that from United States Senator Ted Kennedy? Or from hotshot scot-free movie director Roman Polanski? Or from rap recording star Ice Cube? Or from Ronald Reagan and the Grenada Escapade? Or from George Bush in Panama? Or from George Bush and Colin Powell in the Persian Gulf? Or from the military hero flyboys who returned from bombing the shit out of civilian cities in Iraq and then said, laughing and proud on international TV, "All I need now is a woman"? Or from the hundreds of thousands of American football fans, or from the millions of Americans who would, if they could, pay surrealistic amounts of money just to witness up close somebody like Mike Tyson beat the brains out of somebody? And what could which university teach Mike Tyson about the difference between violence and love? Is there any citadel of higher education in the country that does not pay its football coach at least three times as much as the chancellor, and six times as much as its professors, and 10 times as much as its social and psychological counselors? In this America, where Mike Tyson and I live together and bitterly, bitterly apart, I say he became what he felt. He felt the stigma of a priori hatred and intentional poverty. He was given the choice of violence or violence, the violence of defeat or the violence of victory. Who would pay him to rehabilitate inner city housing or to refurbish a bridge? Who would pay him what to study the facts of our collective history? Who would pay him what to plant and nurture the trees of a forest? And who will write and who will play the songs that tell a guy like Mike Tyson how to talk to a girl? What was America willing to love about Mike Tyson? Or any black man? Or any man's man? Tyson's neighborhood and my own have become the same no-win battleground, and he has fallen there, and I do not rejoice. I do not. This is apple juice, by the way. Poets have terrible reputations. I have to try and clean these up. This week in South Africa, Chris Hani was murdered. He was a militant leader who had the trust, who earned the trust of young people there in South Africa working for freedom and full equality. And I guess, like many others of you, I thought we were on our way in South Africa. We were getting there. I still think we're on our way. I know we're going to get there, but this is a hell of a setback. And this is it's a vile, dastardly murder is what it is. And so I'd like to begin the reading tonight with a few poems that I have written in the context of the South African struggle. I will no longer lightly walk behind a one of you who fear me. Be afraid. I plan to give you reasons for your jumpy fits and facial tics. I will not walk politely on the pavements anymore, and this is dedicated in particular to those who hear my footsteps or the insubstantial rattling of my grocery cart, then turn around, see me, and hurry on away from this impressive terror I must be. I plan to blossom bloody on an afternoon surrounded by my comrades seeing terrible revenge in merciless accelerating rhythms, but I have watched a blind man studying his face. I have set the table in the evening and sat down to eat the news. Regularly I have gone to sleep. There is no one to forgive me. The dead do not give a damn. I live like a lover who drops her dime into the phone just as the subway shakes into the station, wasting her message, canceling the question of her call, fulminating or forgetful but late, and always after the fact that could save or condemn me. I must become the action of my fate. How many of my brothers and my sisters will they kill before I teach myself retaliation? Shall we pick a number? South Africa, for instance. Do we agree that more than 10,000 in less than a year, but that less than 5,000 slaughtered in more than 6 months? Well, what is the matter with me? I must become a menace to my enemies. And if I ever let you slide, who should be extirpated from my universe, who should be cauterized from Earth completely, law and order jerk-offs of the first, the terrorist degree, then let my body fail my soul in its bedeviled lecheries. And if I ever let love go, because the hatred of the whisperings become a phantom dictate I obey, in lieu of impulse and realities, the blossoming flamingos of my wild mimosa trees, then let love frees me out. I must become a menace to my enemies. Poem for South African women. Our own shadows disappear as the feet of thousands by the tens of thousands pound the fallow land into new dust that, rising like a marvelous pollen, will be fertile. Even as the first woman whispering imagination to the trees around her, made for righteous fruit from such deliberate defense of life as no other still will claim, inferior to any other safety in the world. The whispers too, they intimate to the inmost ear of every spirit now aroused, they carousing in ferocious affirmation of all peaceable and loving amplitude sound, a certainly unbounded heat from a baptismal smoke where, yes, there will be fire. And the babies cease alarm as mothers raising arms and heart high as the stars so far unseen, nevertheless hurl into the universe a moving force irreversible as light years traveling to the open eye. And who will join this standing up? And the ones who stood without sweet company will sing and sing back into the mountains and, if necessary, even under the sea. We are the ones we have been waiting for. We are the ones we have been waiting for. Even tonight, and I need to take a walk and clear my head about this poem, about Why I can't go out without changing my clothes, my shoes, my body posture, my gender identity, my age, my status as a woman alone in the evening, alone on the streets, alone, not being the point. The point being that I can't do what I want to do with my own body because I am the wrong sex, the wrong age, the wrong skin. And suppose it was not here in the city, but down on the beach or far into the woods. And I wanted to go there by myself, thinking about God, or thinking about children, or thinking about the world, all of it disclosed by the stars and the silence. I could not go, and I could not think, and I could not stay there alone as I need to be alone, because I can't do what I want to do with my own body. And who in the hell set things up like this? And in France, they say, if the guy penetrates but does not ejaculate, then he did not rape me. And if after stabbing him, if after screams, if after begging the bastard, and if even after smashing a hammer to his head, if even after that, if he and his buddies fuck me after that, then I consented and there was no rape because finally, you understand, finally they fucked me over because I was wrong. I was wrong again to be me, being me where I was, wrong to be who I am, which is exactly like South Africa, penetrating into Namibia, penetrating into Angola. And does that mean, I mean, how do you know if Pretoria ejaculates? What will the evidence look like? The proof of the monster jackboot ejaculation on black land? And if after Namibia, and if after Angola, and if after Zimbabwe, and if after all of my kinsmen and women resist even to self-immolation of the villages, and if after that we lose nevertheless, what will the big boys say? Will they claim my consent? Do you follow me? We are the wrong people of the wrong skin on the wrong continent, and what in the hell is everybody being reasonable about? And according to the Times, back in 66, the CIA decided that they had this problem, and the problem was a man named Nkrumah, so they killed him. And before that, it was Patrice Lumumba, and before that, it was my father on the campus of my Ivy League school, and my father afraid to walk into the cafeteria because he said he was wrong, the wrong age, the wrong skin, the wrong gender identity, and he was paying my tuition. And before that, it was my father saying I was wrong, saying that I should have been a boy because he wanted one, a boy, and that I should have been lighter skinned, and I should have had straighter hair, and that I should not be so boy crazy, but instead I should just be one, a boy. And before that, it was my mother pleading plastic surgery for my nose and braces for my teeth and telling me to let the books loose, to let them loose. In other words, I am very familiar with the problems of the CIA and the problems of South Africa and the problems of Exxon Corporation and the problems of white America in general, and the problems of the teachers and the preachers and the FBI and the social workers and my particular mom and dad. I am very familiar with the problems because the problems turn out to be me. I am the history of rape. I am the history of the rejection of who I am. I am the history of the terrorized incarceration of myself. I am the history of battery, assault, and limitless armies against whatever I want to do with my mind and my body and my soul. And whether it's about walking out at night, or whether it's about the love that I feel, or whether it's about the sanctity of my vagina, or the sanctity of my national boundaries, or the sanctity of my leaders, or the sanctity of each and every desire that I know from my personal and idiosyncratic and indisputably single and singular heart, I have been raped because I have been wrong. The wrong sex, the wrong age, the wrong skin, the wrong nose, the wrong hair, the wrong need, the wrong dream, the wrong geographic, the wrong sartorial. I have been the meaning of rape. I have been the problem everyone seeks to eliminate by forced penetration with or without the evidence of slime. And but let this be unmistakable. This poem is not consent. I do not consent to my mother, to my father, to the teachers, to the FBI, to South Africa, to Bedford Stuy, to Park Avenue, to American Airlines, to the hard-on idlers on the corners, to the sneaky creeps in cars. I am not wrong. Wrong is not my name. My name is my own, my own, my own. And I can't tell you who the hell set things up like this. But I can tell you that from now on, my resistance, my simple and daily and nightly self-determination may very well cost you your life. Short note to my very critical and well-beloved friends and comrades. First, they said I was too light. Then they said I was too dark. Then they said I was too different. Then they said I was too much the same. Then they said I was too young. Then they said I was too old. Then they said I was too interracial. Then they said I was too much a nationalist. Then they said I was too silly. Then they said I was too angry. Then they said I was too idealistic. Then they said I was too confusing altogether. Make up your mind, they said. Are you militant or sweet? Are you vegetarian or meat? Are you straight or are you gay? And I said, hey, it's not about my mind. I had an interesting experience recently. I was talking with the editor, an editor, let's say, to be more discreet, of the Women's Review of Books. And she wanted me to delete some paragraphs in which I called several different kinds of people crazy. And she said, well, if you call those people crazy, you're saying that, you know, maybe half the country is crazy. I said, hey, I'm being nice. So anyway, there's a difference apparently out here in attitudes about craziness and so forth. So I'll read this poem in that context. Remember, I said, an editor. This is called A Poem About Intelligence for My Brothers and Sisters. A few years back, and they told me black means a hole where other folks got brain. It was like the cells in the heads of black children was out to every hour on the hour naps. Scientists called the phenomenon the notorious Jensen lapse, remember? Anyway, I was thinking about how to devise a test for the wise, like a Stanford Binet for the CIA, you know? Take Einstein, being the most, the unquestionable, the outstanding, the maximal mind of the century, right? And I'm struggling against this lapse left over from my black childhood to fathom why anybody should say so. E equals MC squared? I try that on this old lady living on my block. She's sweeping away Saturday night from the stoop, and mad as can be because some absolute jackass have left a king-size mattress where she have to sweep around it, stains and all she don't want to know nothing about in the first place. Mrs. Johnson, I say, leaning on the gate between us, what you think about somebody come up with an E equals MC2? How you doing, she answered me sideways, like she don't want to let on, she know I ain't combed my hair yet. And here it and here it is Sunday morning, but still I have the nerve to be bothering serious work with these crazy questions about E equals what you say again, dear? Then I tell her, well, also this same guy, I think he was undisputed father of the atom bomb. That right, she mumbles or grumbles, not too politely. And didn't remember to wear socks when he put on his shoes, I add on getting desperate, at which point Mrs. Johnson take herself and her broom a very big step down the stoop away from me, and never did nothing for nobody in particular, less than it was a committee, and used to say, what time is it? And you'd say 6 o'clock, and he'd say day or night. And he never made nobody a cup of tea in his whole brilliant life. And my voice rises slightly, and he didn't never boogie, neither never. Well, say Mrs. Johnson, well, honey, I do guess that's genius for you. Okay, now I'd like to read several love poems because it's spring. You have to explain why you're gonna read love poems these days. Right? That's my reason. let's see, I think that's it on passion. So, this is called, this is a sonnet. And since I've been invited to read today by the Poetry Center of San Francisco State, I thought I should at least read one sonnet. I'm serious. The sonnet lives, you know. Sunflower Sonnet number 2. Supposing we could just go on as two, voracious in the days apart as well as when we side by side, the many ways we do that well. I would consider then perfection possible or else worthwhile to think about, which is to say, I guess the costs of long term tend to pile up, block and complicate, erase away the accidental, temporary, near thing, pulse beat promises one makes because the chance, the easy new is there in front of you. But still, perfection takes some sacrifice of falling stars for rare, and there are stars, but none of you to spare. Sad, isn't it? Poem for Haruko. I never thought I'd keep a record of my pain or happiness, like candles lighting the entire soft lace of the air around the full length of your hair, a shower organized by God in brown and auburn undulations, luminous like particles of flame. But now I do retrieve an afternoon of apricots and water interspersed with cigarettes and sand and rocks we walked across. How easily you held my hand beside the low tide of the world. Now I do relive an evening of retreat, a bridge I left behind where all the solid heat of lust and tender trembling lay as cruel and as kind as passion spins its infinite tergiversations in between the bitter and the sweet, alone and longing for you, now I do. This is called a poem about process and progress. Hey, baby. Anyway, there's more. Hey, baby, you better hurry it up because since you went totally off, I seen a full moon, I seen a half moon, I seen a quarter moon, I seen no moon whatsoever. I seen an equinox, I seen a solstice, I seen Mars and Venus on a line, I seen a mess of fickle stars, and lately I seen this new kind of lover on and off the telephone who liked to talk to me all the time, real nice. You must have known that was coming, right? This is called Resolution Number 1003. I will love who loves me. I will love as much as I am loved. I will hate who hates me. I will feel nothing for everyone oblivious to me. I will stay indifferent to indifference. I will live hostile to hostility. I will make myself a passionate and eager lover in response to passionate and eager love. I will be nobody's fool. Sometimes Deliza gets so crazy, she omit the bebop from the concrete, she intimidate the music, she excruciate the whiskey, she obliterate the blow, she sneeze hypothetical at sex. Sometimes Deliza gets so crazy, she abstruse about a barbecue ribs, wonder white bread sandwich in the car with hot sauce make the eyes roll right to where you are fastidious among the fried up chicken wings. Sometimes Deliza gets so crazy, she exasperate on do they hook it up, they being Ingrid Bergman and some paranoid schizophrenic Mr. Gregory Peck Peck, do they hook it up? Sometimes Deliza gets so crazy, she drive right across the water, flying champagne bottles from the bridge. She last drink to close the bars. She holler, kissy lips. She laughs. She lets you walk yourself away. Sometimes Deliza gets so crazy. And this is called Poem About Heartbreak That Go On and On. Bad love lasts like a big, ugly lizard, crawl around the house forever, never die, and never change itself into a butterfly. Oh, dear. I think the last love poem for the night that I read is this one. This is called A Poem on My Happy Matrimonial Condition. Last time I got married was yesterday in bed. We stayed there talking it over. Nobody shook hands, but the agreement felt very good, as a matter of fact. So that was what will be the absolute last time I ever get married. Okay, which leads me to this next poem. This is a poem, it's a letter to Mrs. Virginia Thomas, wife of what's-his-name recently appointed to the Supreme Court. And here I thought I hated him. I mean, I thought that he was loathsome to the nth degree. I saw him as some kind of clown, a first-class colored fool, an Uncle Tom, a peeping Tom, a creepy, eager, pornographic Tom, a hypocrite, a liar, and a fake, a make-believe black man, a mediocre mediocrity of apple-polished, brown-nosed cutthroat, and an insult to his elders, a menace to his peers, a hazard to the under 17, a joke, a serious mistake, a cynical disjuncture between race and history, a cruel interlocutor between the needy and relief, a bullet to the family, a bully to the female, a pietistic turncoat and a trivializing renegade, a jerk, a cornball hustler and a trifling no-count crocodile, a sacrilegious opportunist and a hitman for the pitiless. But I'm completely off the track, mistaken, out of line, and off the wall, it seems, which brings me to this letter I must write to you. I write to thank you for your revelation. I declare, I don't know how the truth escaped my understanding. I can't explain the blindness that concealed the facts from me, but suddenly I looked at you and Clarence, happy as two pods in a poke, or two pigs in a pea, or whatever, on the cover of People magazine, and things just clicked. They really did. I mean, like click, I realized you're right, and I've been dense and dumb and big time into criminal denial, see, because I probably was, as you say, probably I was in love with Clarence. Probably I lusted after him, your husband. Yes, I guess I probably did. And here I thought I hated him. And then you never know. Sometimes it's awful hard to tell now, isn't it? You never know. This is a poem I like to read. I understand that former President George Bush was royally welcomed into the Kingdom of Kuwait today. Only he should be so lucky. So I want to read this poem. It's called The Bombing of Baghdad. The bombing of Baghdad began and did not terminate for 42 days and 42 nights, relentless, minute after minute, more than 110,000 times. We bombed Iraq, we bombed Baghdad, we bombed Basra, we bombed military installations, we bombed the National Museum, we bombed schools, we bombed air raid shelters, we bombed water, we bombed electricity, we bombed hospitals, we bombed streets, we bombed highways, we bombed everything that moved, we bombed everything that did not move, we bombed Baghdad, a city of 5.5 million human beings. We bombed radio towers, we bombed telephone poles, we bombed mosques, we bombed runways, we bombed tanks, we bombed trucks, we bombed cars, we bombed bridges, we bombed the darkness, we bombed the sunlight, we bombed them and we bombed them and we cluster bombed the citizens of Iraq and we sulfur bombed the citizens of Iraq and we napalm bombed the citizens of Iraq and we complemented these bombings, these sorties with Tomahawk cruise missiles which we shot repeatedly by the thousands upon thousands into Iraq, you understand, an Iraqi Scud missile is, quote, militarily insignificant, unquote, and we do not mess around with insignificant, so we use cruise missiles repeatedly. We fired them into Iraq, and I am not pleased. I am not very pleased. None of this fits into my notion of things going very well. The bombing of Baghdad did not obliterate the distance or the time between my body and the breath of my beloved. This was Custer's next to last stand. I hear Crazy Horse singing as he dies. I dedicate myself to learn that song. I hear that music in the moaning of the Arab world. Custer got accustomed to just doing his job, pushing westward into glory, making promises, searching for the savages, their fragile temporary settlements for raising children, dancing down the rain, and praying for the mercy of a herd of buffalo. Custer, he pursued these savages. He attacked at dawn. He murdered the men, murdered the boys. He captured the women and converted them, I'm sure, to his religion. Oh, how gently did he bid his darling fiancée farewell. How sweet the gaze her eyes bestowed upon her warrior. Loaded with guns and gunpowder, he embraced the guts and gore of manifest white destiny. He pushed westward to annihilate the savages, attack at dawn, and seize their territories, seize their women, seize their natural wealth. And I am cheering for the arrows and the braves. And all who believed some must die, they were already dead. And all who believed they only possessed human being, they no longer stood among the possibly humane. And all who believed that retaliation, revenge, defense, and attack derived from God-given prerogatives of white men. And all who believed that waging war is anything besides terrorist activity in the first place and in the last. And all who believe that F-15s, F-16s, Apache helicopters, B-52 bombers, smart bombs, dumb bombs, napalm, artillery, battleships, nuclear warheads amount to anything other than terrorist tools of a terrorist undertaking. And all who believed that Holocaust means something that happens only to white people. And all who believed that Desert Storm signified anything besides the delivery of an American Holocaust against the Arab peoples of the Middle East, all who believed these things, they were already dead. They no longer stood among the possibly humane. And this is for Crazy Horse singing as he dies, because I live inside his grave. And this is for the victims of the bombing of Baghdad, because the enemy traveled from my house to blast your homeland into pieces of children and pieces of sand. And in the aftermath of carnage perpetrated in my name, how should I dare to offer you my hand? How shall I negotiate the implications of my shame? My heart cannot confront this death without relief. My soul will not control this leaking of my grief. And this is for Crazy Horse singing as he dies. And here is my song of the living who must sing against the dying, sing to join the living with the dead. A poem I just began this afternoon. It's not quite finished. I had a lot of other things to do. Too bad. There is no oil between her legs. That four-year-old Muslim girl and that five-year-old sister of the Muslim girl and that 12-year-old cousin of the Muslim girl and that 15-year-old neighbor of the Muslim girl and that 21-year-old mother of that four-year-old, that Muslim child, gang-raped from dawn to dark to time become damnation. Too bad there is no oil between her legs. The woman in Somalia, weighing 45 pounds, and who has buried village elders, and who has buried village children, who weighed even less than she weighs after so many days of hunger, gaping open to the flies. Too bad there is no oil in South Central LA, and in between the beaten men and beat up women, and in between the African and Asian throwaways, and in between the Spanish and the English speaking homeless, and in between the dealers and the drugged, and in between the people and police out of control. Too bad there is no oil. Too bad there is no oil between her legs. That four-year-old Muslim girl, child of oblivion and international inertia and national turpitude and screaming naked need. Too bad there is no oil between her legs. Read two more poems tonight. This other poem is the Irish poem I told you about. It's called Love Song About Choosing Your Booze. On a rainy Ireland night, way west towards the sea, and quite inside the wee Lewiston bar, and also close to three guys shooting pool, and must be awful close to God, considering we found two seats while everybody else was standing, packed with Guinness Stout or Powers or Paddy's Whiskey well in hand. I listened to this stammering and political Belfast poet reading me his new translation of Le Bateau Ivre. Drunk boat, he emphasized the two stressed syllables, drunk boat. And then began to sing real slow. He sang to me deep and he sang to me low. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. And I slipped back to Mississippi and to Brooklyn and to Belfast. And I finally came back intoxicated to the shock of that song, my song no longer, or not only mine. And I decided I didn't really much care if it was Powers or Paddy's filling up my glass. So long as it was Irish, I'd be fine, just fine. Conclude tonight with this poem called Free Flight. Nothing fills me up at night I fall asleep for 1 or 2 hours, then up again my gut alarms, and I must arise, and wandering into the refrigerator, think about evaporated milk, homemade vanilla ice cream, cherry pie hot from the oven, with something like Vermont cheddar cheese disintegrating luscious on the top, while mildly I devour almonds and raisins mixed to mathematical criteria, or celery, or my very own sweet and sour snack composed of brie, peanut butter, honey, and a minuscule slice of party-sized salami on a single whole wheat cracker, no salt, added, or I read César Vallejo, Gabriela Mistral, last year's complete anthology, or I might begin another list of things to do that starts with toilet paper, and I notice that I never jot down fresh strawberry shortcake, never, even though fresh strawberry shortcake shoots down raisins and almonds 6-0 effortlessly. Is this poem on my list? Light bulbs, lemons, envelopes, ballpoint refill, post office, and zucchini oranges? No, it's not. I guess that means I just forgot. Walking my dog around the block leads to a space in my mind where, during the newspaper strike, questions sizzle through suddenly like, is there an earthquake down in Ecuador? Did a TWA super saver flight to San Francisco land in Philadelphia instead? Or whatever happened to human rights in Washington, D.C.? Or what about downward destabilization of the consumer price index? And I was in the school, P.S. Tum to Tum, and time came for me to leave, but no, I couldn't leave. The rule was anybody leaving the premises without having taught somebody something valuable would be henceforth prescribed from the premises, would be forever null and void, dull and vilified. Well, I had stood in front of 40 to 50 students running my mouth, and I had been generous with deceitful smiles, soft-spoken and pseudo-gentle wiles, if and when forced into discourse amongst such adults as constitutes the regular treacheries of on-the-job behavior. On-the-job behavior. Is this poem on that list? Polished shoes, file nails, coordinate tops and bottoms, lipstick control, no screaming, I'm bored, because this is whoring away the hours of God's creation. Pay attention to your eyes, your hands, the twilight sky in the institutional big windows. No, I did not presume. I was not so bold as to put this poem on that list. Then, at the end of the class, this boy gives me Mahler's Ninth Symphony, the double album. Listen to it. Let it seep into you, he says. Transcendental love, he says. I think, nah. I've been angry all day long. Nobody did the assignment. I am not prepared. I am not prepared for so much grace, the catapulting music of surprise that makes me hide away my face. Nothing fills me up at night. Yesterday, the house guest left a brown towel in the bathroom for tonight. I set out a blue one and an off-white washcloth. Seriously, I don't need no house guest. I don't need no towels lovers. I just need a dog. Maybe I'm kidding. Maybe I need a woman. A woman be so, well, you know, so wife-like, so more or less motherly, so listening, so much the universal skin you love to touch, and who, the closer she gets to you, the better she looks to me. Somebody say yes and make me laugh and tell me she knows, she been there, she spit bullets at my enemy. She say, you need to sail around Alaska. Fuck it all. Try this new cerebral tea and take a long bath. Maybe I need a man. A man be so, well, you know, so manly, so lifelike, so more or less virile, so sure, so much the deep voice of opinion and the shoulders like a window seat and cheeks so closely shaven by a twin-edged razor blade, no oily hair and no dandruff besides. Somebody say yes and make me laugh and tell me he know, he been there, he spit bullets at my enemies. He say, you need to sail around Alaska, fuck it all, and take a long bath. La-ti-da and la-ti-dum. What's the socialized obsession with the bathtub? Maybe I just need to love myself, myself. Anyhow, I'm more familiar with the subject. Maybe when my cousin tells me, you remind me of a woman past her prime, maybe I need to hustle my cousin into a hammerlock position, make her cry out, uncle, and I'm sorry. Maybe when I feel this horrible inclination to kiss folks I despise because the party's like that, an occasion to be kissing people you despise, maybe I should tell them, kindly kiss my... Maybe when I wake up in the middle of the night, I should go downstairs, dump the refrigerator contents on the floor and stand there in the middle of the spilled milk and the wasted butter spread beneath my dirty feet, writing poems, writing poems. Maybe I just need to love myself, myself. In any way, I'm working on it.